I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, writer Ivy Pacoda on her LA-based novel, Wonder Valley. Ivy Pacoda grew up in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn. She is the author of the critically acclaimed novels The Art of Disappearing, Visitation Street, and Wonder Valley, which is the book we're going to be talking about today. Her writing has appeared in publications including the Los Angeles Review of Books, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. She lives in Los Angeles currently and teaches creative writing at Studio 526 in Skid Row, where she helped found Skid Row Zine. Ivy, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much.
So before we talk about the book, I want to talk about Skid Row. Skid Row is a term that everybody knows in the UK, but I don't think most people would understand that it's actually a place.
It is a place. It's a neighborhood in downtown Los Angeles. It's not an official neighborhood. They were just denied permission to found their own neighborhood council, which is very disappointing. Which is a local branch of non-official government, but it means that it's a neighborhood. It is the largest homeless community in the world. It is a sprawling community, a neighborhood that reaches from Alameda Street to Los Angeles Street and from, I don't know, the borders are so fluid because it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but it is a definite neighborhood in downtown. And it's a lot different than people think. You know, superficially, it looks like you might imagine homeless people sleeping on the streets. I don't know. It's more. It's a bit more of an American thing, though. Being around London recently, I do see a lot of people sleeping on the streets in sleeping bags. But in LA, people are allowed to sleep in tents. So the streets are just completely lined with tents, and then there are official encampments that people, so not official, but like ad hoc encampments where people all live together. And it's unique and interesting, and it has a lot more depth and social development than many people think.
And what about sort of the streets around? So obviously, like Los Angeles, like anywhere now, is a place that's getting more and more expensive to live. Mm-hmm. So is the sort of area gentrifying?
It's a very good question. So it's very interesting, the location of Skid Row. It is, so there's downtown LA, which was the sort of movie mecca in the before the 1920s. And Charlie Chaplin had built his theater for his own premieres there. And there are a bunch of these huge theaters on Broadway. And then after the 20s, the movie industry, for many reasons, moved to the West, where they could build bigger studios. And downtown had been very cool and very vibrant and became derelict. And there were a lot of these older, and downtown's also where Bunker Hill is, which is where a lot of the noir stories take place. A lot of noir movies are set in Bunker Hill. Skid Row is at the far south side of downtown. And south of Skid Row is a warehouse district. And in most, you know, first world cities, when you have a warehouse district, suddenly you get artists. And so downtown is coming back, and the warehouse district, which is called the Arts District, is gentrifying at an alarming rate. And Skid Row is squeezed between these neighborhoods. Now you'll see, if you look at real estate listing, that there are apartments on San Pedro Street, which is like literally in the heart of Skid Row. For me, that's not a problem. For a lot of people, I think they'd be quite surprised that they're buying an apartment in Skid Row. And, you know, it is a problem. But I worry, of course, that, well, it's interesting because the rents that are rising have nothing to do with the people on the street. There is low-income housing, and they're trying to build more. And I'm not saying it's perfect, but there are a lot of plans afoot to get more low-income housing and to convert the old police plaza, Parker Center, into low-income housing. But these two neighborhoods, the Arts District and downtown, are starting to expand into that area. So we'll see what's going to happen. You know, they try to sweep people off the streets more regularly, but at the same time, the homeless population of Los Angeles is exploding at an exponential rate. So it seems like there's no way to get rid of Skid Row.
And so this arts program that you work on, tell us about that.
So Studio 526 is an art studio that's affiliated with a multi-platform outreach center that was formerly called LAMP, which stood for the Los Angeles Men's Project, which they had to change recently to, although it's a beautiful name for a place that deals with homelessness and poverty, to the People Concern. And the People Concern provides all different types of services, from emergency shelter to long-term housing. They have a bunch of buildings for long-term housing, to various educational services like money management, healthcare. But they also have this incredible art studio, which, you know, it seems better than the art studio in many high schools. It's super vibrant. There's a music room, and there's painting and photography. And I run the creative writing section of it, or I teach at the creative writing section of it. Most people who are part of the studio come every day, and they're very extended studio hours, 4 to 5 hours a day if they want. And I run the creative writing workshop on Mondays, and I also run something called Skid Row Zine, which is a, you know, traditional zine, like an ad hoc magazine for voices of Skid Row to celebrate like the joy and the positivity of life downtown. That's what they say. People don't say I live in Skid Row. They say I went downtown, which I think is really cool.
And beyond, obviously, you know, the base level of just somewhere for people to be at the day off the streets, are you like, which is a good in itself, obviously, what are some of the people that take the class like? I mean, how are you getting people that are, you know, that are
okay,
talented?
So, well, if you take the class, you have to be at least part of LAMP or the People Concern. So they just changed it. You have to be somewhat vetted by the studio. So people aren't just wandering in off the street. There is some checks and balances, although we don't have mental health checks and balances. So if someone's having a bad day, we have no one to, like, there's no guard who's dealing with that. And that's something that we, so the people are a little different than you might imagine. Most of them, well, many of them do not actually live on the street anymore. They've been housed, or they found their own housing, or they're moving into, you know, shelter for HIV positive, trans. LAMP, the People Concern, is one of the only programs that doesn't require sobriety for inclusivity, which is great because, like,
you wouldn't have anybody.
Yeah, I don't really understand, because I'm not really on the, like, activist outreach side. I don't really understand a lot of the way things work. And that's one of the things that kind of blows my mind. Like, you know, is everyone lying? So the LAMP has, you know, people are addicted, and not, you know, if you're visibly addicted and you're in the studio, that's a real problem. But, you know, people, you know, use medical marijuana to cope and whatever. So most of the people are no longer the kind of homeless you might imagine, like collecting cans and bottles, although some of them do. Most of them no longer sleep on the street, although all of them have. The majority of our students are, not students, I should say participants or writers, because they really are artists, are 50 and up. So they're an older generation. Though, oddly, we'll have some college students. There's a couple who come who are in college, and they live on the street, and they go to Los Angeles Community College, and they're a very odd couple for various reasons. And I can't ask too many questions about people's stories. If they tell me, they tell me. If they don't, they don't. But I do, you know, many of the people, I know everything about their situation. But, you know, some of them, one of our students is a writer. She's an artist. She went to art school in her 60s. She got cancer, lost all her money, and wound up living on the street, or as she says, in the elements. And she's got a daughter and who lives in a house in Texas, and a sister who lives in a really nice house with a pool in Pasadena. So it's like, you know, they're, and she's incredibly well-educated. She went to art school. She lives from Queens, New York. Another guy, he's like, he worked as an activities coordinator at a senior citizen center, and he just made a lot of mistakes in his life, and he's trying to right that ship, but he can lead the class when I'm not there. And he's, you know, he's like completely, you would have no, I mean, not that I keep saying this, but you would have no idea if he was sitting in this room today that he struggled the sort of issues that you might imagine make you homeless. So it's really cool. And they're, you know, some of them are incredibly literate, incredibly well-read, completely capable of writing at a very high level that I would never need to edit or, you know, step in. And some of them, many of whom are actually immigrants, who have English as a second language, have more struggles with the writing. But, you know, it is the level of education kind of blew my mind when I first got there.
So Wonder Valley, let's talk about the book.
Oh, that's right.
How would you describe the novel?
Well, it's a multi-perspective novel stretching from the desert outside of Los Angeles, the Mojave, to Skid Row, that examines how five disparate characters who are all searching for redemption, how their lives come together in surprising and revelatory ways, many of whom intersect in Skid Row in Los Angeles.
And I'd normally say, why LA? Obviously, we've already mentioned you live there and we've been talking about it nearly for 10 minutes. But this is obviously a very different LA. We think we're familiar with LA from, you know, obviously from Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But this clearly is a very different LA to what we normally see.
Well, that's why I wrote about it, because, you know, I'm not from LA. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, the LA that I imagined I was going to live in when I moved there is that LA, like Beverly Hills 90210 and Joan Didion and, you know, Malibu. And, you know, I'd like, I never go to the beach. I just started recently because I have a daughter and that's something we do, but I never go to Beverly Hills. I'm rarely on the West Side. And, you know, I need to write about the place where I'm living. It's very hard to imagine. Like, I don't understand when someone goes to Greece and they're like, oh, I'm writing a whole book set on this place I went on vacation for 3 days. I'm like, that's incredible. Because do you really know it? But I have to know the place I'm writing about. And that happens to be Los Angeles. But it's very fraught to write about LA because, you know, I don't know it that well, or the parts I know are a little bit different. And I didn't set out to like pull the, you know, curtain back on this underexplored or underrepresented part of the city, but I suddenly realized that the places that I hang out in LA are slightly different and that they're quite underrepresented. And it was really cool when I started to write to realize that the city I was writing about is not something I'd ever read about before. And I thought that's really why LA. I was like, I have to write about this. You know, I've never read about it.
And what do you think? I mean, obviously, as you said, you've been there for a while and you feel you need to be somewhere and get under the skin of it before you actually want to write about it. But what do you think being an outsider, being someone that's from the East Coast brings to that?
Well, I mean, a certain amount of distance, and I'm not, you know, a certain amount of inability to be deluded by the whole city. I am also a lot of caution, too. Like, I'm not pretending to know LA better than anyone else. In fact, I think, you know, writing about a place that you're learning about brings like a perspective that is really interesting to readers. You know, I wrote my last previous novels about Brooklyn, and I was panicked the whole time because I was like, this is where I'm from and I have to get it right. And I was so panicked about getting it right that I changed the name of the neighborhood from what it really is, Red Hook, to a fake name just to make sure in case I got it wrong, no one could say anything. And then I changed it back. But the idea of being an outsider, none of my characters are from LA, I don't think. All of them have come there. So they're learning about it as I'm learning about it. And sort of that's the perspective I can write from, is of people who are just starting to experience it for the same amount of time that I have.
And that's obviously, you know, whenever we think of LA again in the sort of popular imagination, it's always people that have come to LA rather than, does anybody come from LA?
I mean, yeah, no, yes, people do come from LA. You know, there are many, but yeah, I think that it has this idea of manifest destiny and like a place to sort of reinvent yourself and start over. And I think that's the huge allure and like the also distraction and, you know, the danger of LA is that it affords this idea of possibility that's actually somewhat of a lie. Like, what are you going to achieve there that's like going to happen that couldn't happen somewhere else, you know? Like, and I think people have this like ideal of Southern California, and some of them really go for that sort of surfer, you know, laid back vibe. I'm just going to like live on the beach and do all these things, though that's becoming increasingly unaffordable. But yeah, there's a definite culture of people from LA who are a little bit suspicious of us newcomers writing about it. And there are all these conversations like, who writes LA best? Is it like Joan Didion or Michael Connelly, or who's actually not from LA, you know? So it is, it's tricky.
Those are just people that came to LA like 20 or 30 years ago rather than like today.
Yeah.
Yeah, like LA seems like the sort of like American dream writ large, this idea that you can go to a place and be anything you want, but of course really it's bullshit.
Well, yeah, because the American dream is like the American dream is really something that belongs to white men only. You know, the American dream didn't really exist for, you know, African Americans or Native Americans or immigrants crossing the border. It's sort of this like construct of white male masculinity. And like, so it doesn't really work out for a lot of people. But because white men often control the world, they're pitching this dream to everybody. And then a lot of people really don't succeed in, you know, realizing it. But LA, of course, because the film industry, which again was a, something that was started by white men, you know, and put, this myth was promulgated, you know, like, hey, come and do this, you know, it's for everybody, but it really isn't. And that's not to say it isn't a wonderful place. It really is. It's wild and diverse and unknowable. And it's so great to live in a city where there's so much left to explore on a daily basis. But like, yeah, I mean, it is this weird embodiment of the American dream in the sense that it's a place where dreams can really be broken.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Listed to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Ivy Pacoda. We're talking about her latest novel, Wonder Valley. And Ivy, the novel starts with a happening, a thing that sort of becomes like an internet sensation, like a meme, a event. Tell us about that.
Well, the book starts with a naked man running the wrong way through traffic during the morning rush hour commute, which is just like such an anathema in Los Angeles. The rush hour commute is sacred. You don't mess with it. You don't do stupid stuff during it. You don't make people's lives harder by slowing down their already incredibly slow commute. But it's also this great equalizing force. It's one of the only times that everyone in the city, regardless of socioeconomic class or job or whatever, or even if they don't work, like, you know, I work, but I work at home. I take my daughter to school. We're all tied to traffic. So this is a moment that captures the attention of the entire city, for better or for worse.
And then there's a series of characters that their story is told repeatedly throughout the book that have some sort of connection to this event. We go sort of backwards and forwards in time as well in some of those perspectives. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But tell us about some of the people.
Okay, well, there's the young man who's running through traffic, who I'm not going to tell you who it is, because that might give a few things away. There is a young man who's just arrived in Los Angeles. He arrived from my previous book, Visitation Street. He is an ex-juvenile offender who has come to Los Angeles to look for his mother, who's living in Skid Row.
That's Ren. So Ren. Can you talk about why you wanted to carry on his story first?
Yeah. So in... Like Wonder Valley, Visitation Street is a multi-perspective novel, and I think there are also five characters. Ren is not one of those five characters, but he's the most important person in the book. So he doesn't have a perspective, and I felt that he had a little more story left to be told. So he came back. Everyone asked me when I was touring for that book, what happened to Ren? Where is he? And I thought, well, I don't know. The book is over. And then I realized I wanted to know. You know, it was kind of a cool revelation for me that the book didn't end, actually. It kept going. There's Tony, a sort of everyman lawyer who witnesses this man running through traffic, who has a sort of Michael Douglas falling down style breakdown and realizes that his life is too strictured and boring and he needs to take action. There's Britt, a former collegiate tennis player who has made some terrible mistakes. And she is in both time periods in the novel. At one point, she's living in a commune in the desert. Another point, she's sort of hanging around Skid Row a little bit. And there's James, a young man who's grown up in the desert on a commune with his father, and whose life just seems to be being derailed by his father's practices and the way he's leading the commune. And finally, there's Blake, my favorite character, who's a criminal with a partner named Sam, who he loves, although he's not romantically in love with, who has no idea how to live a life aside from a life of crime, but also understands that crime is bad and but just can't see a way to, you know, right the wrongs he's done. So he's conflicted.
And all five of those characters have got some past, some sort of thing that they're guilty about or running away from.
They sure do. But I had no idea until halfway through the book. I was like, oh, it's funny. Like, everyone seems to maybe have, like, killed someone or hurt someone really badly. That's weird. I had no idea.
So... let's just talk about that multi-perspective thing again. So as you mentioned, Visitation Street also did that. What is it about that sort of structure that appeals to you?
Sure. So when I first start writing, I'm really – the first thing that occurs to me to write about is setting. Like, I'm obsessed with place and understanding a place. And especially writing about Los Angeles, like, I started to write this book in a way to get to know my city. But there's never one way to look at a place. You know, a place is three-dimensional. It's a globe. It's a neighborhood. It's a diorama. So to look at it through one perspective sort of is too narrow, at least for me, or at least for my need to understand a place. I like to sort of pivot around to see it from other perspectives. So it gives them a more like three-dimensional take. But the other reason is I don't know what I'm doing when I write. So I'll write to the end of one character, a chapter, I'm like, well, that's interesting. I have no idea what's happening with him next. Let's try someone new and see if maybe I can make this link up. So that's the real answer.
You mentioned the commune. This commune's out in the desert near a place called the literally named 29 Palms. And it's, you know, as I said, quite a distance from LA. And it's grim, shall we say, the goings on that commune. Where does that commune come from?
Well, you know, some of the practices are based on various sort of self-help religions like Est, which now has become Landmark Forum, and another one called Synanon, which was a big sort of like 1960s, 1970s self-help, self-realization religion. It also comes from a friend of mine who grew up in a commune. Though I didn't know that when I was writing the book, and it took me a really long time to realize that that was something I'd had experienced. But it's not based on the practices of this commune are not based on the practices of the commune where I had visited. But my friend did grow up in a commune and his father was the leader of it. So I he struggled with that and sort of that's the part that I sort of took was to understand like what it feels like to have your father be a leader and telling other people what to do and have other people sort of obey and adhere to your father's teachings, whereas you might not want to. So that's sort of I married those two ideas of these like California has this huge tradition of fringe religion, you know, it's the end of the world, reinvention. There's sort of power in the desert. So I married those two things together. That idea of like, what would it be like if your people believed your father, but you knew he was a phony? Or maybe he wasn't, and you just don't understand because you just don't have the belief and this idea that California gives rise to a lot of strange beliefs.
And just one more thing from me, and then I'll get you to read a bit of Wonder Valley if you would. So, this is always an interesting question to ask when a setting of a book is somewhere again that we think we're so familiar with from other art forms. But what other writing was an influence on this novel particularly?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. No one's actually asked me that directly. They always ask you, what are you reading? And then you can't think of a single book you've ever read, like ever. Let's see. I mean, John Fante's Ask the Dust was a big influence on it. A lot of California books like Walter Mosley, not in terms of style, but in terms of the ability for those books to traverse a wide swath of California really interested me. And, you know, some of the books that influence Visitation Street really also influence this book structurally. Carson McCullough's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which has a multi-perspective take on a small town. And this book by Yi Young Lee called The Vagrants, which is about an execution and about a bunch of different people sort of reacting to that. And then, of course, the book that always influences me in everything is Don DeLillo's Underworld, because it has this amazing prologue that can stand alone and sort of sets the whole book in motion about a baseball game. And, you know, this is sort of my Don DeLillo homage, you know, the idea that there's this event that sort of captures the rapt attention of the city. Okay. Los Angeles, 2010. He is almost beautiful, running with the San Gabriels over one shoulder, the rise of the Hollywood Freeway as it arcs above the Pasadena Freeway over the other. He is shirtless, the hint of swimmer's muscle rippling below his tan skin, his arms pumping in a 1-2 rhythm in sync with the beat of his feet. There's a chance you envy him. 7 a.m. traffic is already jammed through downtown, ground to a standstill as cars attempt to cross 5 lanes, moving in increments so small their progress is nearly invisible. They merge in jerks and starts from the Pasadena Freeway onto the Hollywood or the Santa Ana, but he is flowing freely, reverse commuting through the stalled vehicles. The drivers watch from behind their steering wheels, distracted from toggling between radio stations, fixing their makeup in the rear view, talking to friends back east for whom the day is fully formed. They left home early, hoping to avoid the bumper-to-bumper, the inevitable slowdown of their mornings. They've mastered their mathematical calculations, the distance times rate times time of the trip to work. Yet they are stuck. In the city of drivers, he is a rebuke. He runs unburdened by the hundreds of sacrifices these commuters have made to arrive at this traffic jam on time. The breakfast missed, the children unseen, the husband abandoned in bed, the night cut short on account of the early morning, the weak gas station coffee, the unpleasant carpool, the sleep loss, the hasty shower, last night's clothes, last night's makeup. He ignores the commuters sealed off in their climate-controlled cars, trapped in the first news cycle in the wheel of Top 40. He holds the straight line through the morning's small desperations, the problems waiting to unfold, the desire to be elsewhere, to be anywhere but here today and tomorrow and all the mornings that run together into one citywide tangle of freeways and on-ramp closures and sig alerts, a whole day narrowed to the stop and go. His expression is mid-marathon serene, focused on the goal and yet not overwhelmed by the distance. He shows no strain. But the woman in a battered soft-top convertible will say he looked drugged. The man in a souped-up hatchback claims he was crazy high, totally loco, you know what I mean. A couple of teenage girls driving an SUV way beyond their pay grade insist that, although they barely noticed him, he looked like a superhero, but not one of the cool ones. The day is an indeterminate weatherless gray. The sun is just another thing delayed this morning. Beneath the 10, the air over the bungalows of West Adams and Pico Union is a dull apocalyptic color, the color of bad things or their aftermath. The other city, the remembered and imagined one, stretches west, past the sprawling ethnic neighborhoods where Koreans overlap with Salvadorans and Armenians back into ties. It begins in the big-name crosstown boulevards lined with deco theaters, faded tropical motels, and restaurants with sentinel valets, and ends where the streets run into the ocean. But in this trench where the 110 sinks through downtown, that place is barely a memory. Here there is only the jam of the cars and the blank faces of the glass towers. The runner is on pace for an 8-minute mile, or so it seems, to the man behind the wheel of his SUV, who woke up late and didn't have time for his own jog. He missed his pre-dawn tour of Beverlywood, the empty silence of the residential neighborhood when he visits other people's cul-de-sacs, peering into living rooms of dark houses as his pedometer records his footsteps, marking calories and distance until the morning's ritual is complete. He wonders what went unseen. Coyotes slinking home before sunup, a car haphazardly left in a driveway after one too many, a man sleeping in the blue glare of his TV, a teenager sneaking through her back gate, liquor bottles shoved into bags and left at someone else's curb. During these stolen hours before his wife and kids need him, he believes he glimpses his neighborhood's secret soul, seeing behind the facades of the bungalows and the manicured squares of unremarkable lawns into hidden discontents. There's never anyone to encourage him on these early morning runs, no one to witness his labored breathing in the sixth mile, his heroic triumph over his ebbing willpower. Watching the runner navigate the stationary cars, this driver is unaware of the jellied muscles of his own legs after a weekend's drinking. He wants to reach back for the hour he cheated from himself, when he lay in bed and instead of lacing up his shoes, rolled over, checking the clock to see how long before others needed him. Without his run, today will belong to the commuters in their cars, to the team waiting for him at work, and now to this shirtless jogger cutting through traffic on the 110. He rolls down his window and wedges his torso out to watch the runner pass. The man's mechanics aren't bad, his chest upright, shoulders relaxed, hands not balled into fists. He cups a hand over his mouth, shouting at the man to keep going. Then he sees that the runner is naked. He pulls back inside, raises the window, and busies himself with his cell phone, moving on to the next thing in his day.
So I've been talking to Ivy Pacoda. We've been talking about her new novel, Wonder Valley, which is out now in the UK from Indigo Press. Ivy, thank you so much for coming in and talking about it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.